beautiful. Thank you, Linda. Thank you, everyone, for coming out today. It's so nice to see your faces, some familiar faces out here, and some recent new faces. Welcome to the Presbyterian Church of the Covenant. I am not Mark Sandlin, in case anyone was wondering. No, I am not Mark. My name is Gracia. Gracia Wright. Mark emailed me and asked me if I could speak today in his absence. My first thought was absolutely not. And as I was typing that on my cell phone, I got quickened and I said, well, I really hate for Mark to have to go around and around trying to find someone to speak. So surely there'll be something I can talk about. So let's see if I've got something for you here or not. All right, so I want to talk on conscious compassion, because this church does an excellent job at being consciously compassionate. I have been a part of churches probably all my life. I come from a family that is very religious, but this is the first church where, in my opinion, no matter how small the numbers are, we do a lot in the community and with one another, to be compassionate, to share, to serve. And I am so happy to be a part of this group. So thank you very much. So is anyone familiar with the book Australian Dreaming? Anyone heard that book? So it's called Australian Dreaming, 40,000 Years of Aboriginal History. It's by Jennifer Isaacs. Anyway, it's the first Aboriginal history of that continent and its people, as told by the storytellers. Usually our history is not told by those whom the history is about, but it's told by somebody else. So this book is a good one. So there is a quote from an Aboriginal elder, and it says, and it resonates with me, I'm sure you've heard it, "We are all visitors to this time, this place. We are just passing through. Our purpose here is to observe, to learn, to grow, to love. And then we return home." So to observe means to see deeply without judgment. To learn means take the time to understand. To grow means to increase within ourselves our capacity for even loving ourselves without judgment. And then to love means to demonstrate it around you, amongst you, friends, strangers alike. And then we return home. So here it is, that action, that love action of kindness, generosity, gratitude. Those are actually the elements of conscious compassion. It's kind of the thing that the first part is the part that I think a lot of times we miss. A lot of times we'll see something that needs to be done, but we don't take the time to sort of observe, to sort of enter into that other person's shoes, that other person's life, their history, their thought processes. We just see the issue, and then we go to move in action. But these parts of observing, learning, growing, are all necessary before the loving. So conscious compassion is revolutionary when it's undertaken with the intention of easing other people's tension. When we're truly conscious, we do more than just ease other people's tension, though. We also reveal to those people the value of their lives and a vision of virtue that's tangible, that's terrestrial, that's inspired by a sense of transcendence, that rejects limits, it rejects logic, and it rejects inhibitions. Our willingness to be this way, to be present, to be what the young folks say, awoke, is an act so candid that it reveals the conscious and acts as a sponsor in helping to transform humanity. We don't see our actions that way, though, as transforming humanity oftentimes. And the reason we don't is because we really, in our actions, we don't get to go as far as our actions do when we do them. But the times that we are able to go as far as our actions, when we are lucky enough to see that smile on someone's face or the relief in their eyes, then we're able to exhibit that conscious compassion. It becomes reciprocal. So something greater than what we see occurs when we are deliberate in our desire to deposit love and humanity. However, sometimes even those we help or have helped in the past, they're not always even aware of the depth or the impact of our acts. Most of us have to live forward in order to look back with clarity, to understand clearly the impact of our actions. Consider, for an example, so my parents were both school teachers. So consider how many of their words were probably considered dull and uninspiring at the time by the teenagers. They probably couldn't wait to get out of the math class or the science class. Consider all of those kinds of seeds that even for us, people have sown. And even my parents probably thought when they looked at the faces of the students that their words were dull and uninspiring. Or consider my example of being a recipient of conscious compassion. It probably started earlier than 5 years old, but that's when I can remember sort of the seeds being sown in my life. There was an incident that occurred where a relative caused me to end up having permanent blindness. And so for months, after I was recuperating as a five-year-old from this major surgery in the colored hospital. So that's another story. Thank goodness there was Dr. Harvey Rubin in town who was able to do that surgery. So anyway, so for months I lay there in that bed, and they, during those days, they covered both your eyes, even though the partial blindness didn't necessarily affect both eyes. They had to cover both of them. I don't know why they did that those days. But anyway, so for months I just lay in that bed in total darkness. Boy, that could have been a real boring time for a five-year-old while all the other friends were outside playing with whatever they were playing with at that time. I guess slinkies and bicycles and toads in the local pond. But I couldn't do any of that stuff. But I was overtaken by the kindness of my adult relatives, my cousins, my neighbors from across the street and up the street, who would come and sit with me for hours and talk. And so I had all this adult conversation going on around me for days, for weeks, for months. Stories that they would share, deposits that they would leave. I had a cat that was given to me. They told me it was white, so I named him Snowball. Snowball would sit on my bed every day until my sister-in-law Jackie would come, and then Snowball would leave because Jackie didn't like any cats. So when we come to realize this interconnectedness between all sentient beings, we start to realize that compassion is not only a polite or ethical thing to do, it's really the only sensible thing to do. It is the way forward for all of us in humanity. It is the way, the life, the road that we should be walking on. Dr. James Doty, I think it's at Stanford, says, kindness is an active form of compassion. Instead of simply wanting to alleviate someone's suffering, you're actually doing something. So just by sitting there, talking to me, laughing with me, sharing stories, they were exhibiting conscious compassion. And he further says, we now know that this not only leaves a positive mark on the lives of others, but makes you feel great. It literally gives you a natural high. So to keep me occupied, those the older ones, like my aunt, particularly my aunt Ovita, who was the family historian, who herself ended up blind later on in life, would tell me the story of my great-grandma Emma Wade Wagner, who they said was an extraordinary minister and had gifts that, they say, were passed down to her lineage. Some say I have some of those gifts. I don't know. I think I have gifts, but I don't think that's the kind they're talking about. So they said she had these extraordinary gifts that, you know, people would come to her from miles around to have their healing. You know, when you look at her pictures, she was a very petite woman, dark complexion, very silvery hair. It looks like an afro kind of today. She would always be sitting on her porch, they say, in her rocking chair, writing poetry, writing songs, praying, reading the Bible. So, great-grandma Emma Wade Wagner had those characteristics that contributed to this reputation here in Greensboro as being an extraordinary healer. When someone fell sick, they would call upon Miss Emma, who would pray with this intensity, rub oils on their forehead until they were better. So there's this one story every family member, even to this day, will tell of this person who I'll call Mr. Ferguson. So Mr. Ferguson was a white man who lived in what we now call East Greensboro. And in those days, hospitals were few and far between and not easily gotten to, okay? So when Mr. Ferguson's five-year-old son fell ill, people went to the local physician to get him to come to the house. You know, back in that day, they came to your house. But by the time the local medical doctor got there, the little boy had already died, and he was 5 years old, by the way, the exact same age that I was laying in the bed when they're telling these stories. My Aunt Olvida said, the people told her they could hear the wails, the crying and the wailing about this little boy for a 1 mile, 2 miles away. This person, whoever he was evidently an important someone in the community, and everyone was sick that he had died. But somebody had the wherewithal to go grab Miss Emma, who was sitting on her porch. And what happened not too long after that was no less than a miracle. By the time my great-grandmama got through praying, oiling, laying her hands on him, and getting what they call happy in the spirit, the little boy had come back to life. So as I look back on that time, which were dark times for me at such a young age, I see with gratitude and appreciation that the words that people shared and the acts that they did when they visited, which at the time may have to them seemed ever so small, actually helped me ever so much on my journey. They were watersheds. That was actually probably my first watershed moment. Those seeds of conscious compassion were deposited in my soul and remain today. So conscious compassion isn't merely about what we receive or how we serve. It's about our ability to be present as we serve and as we receive. In being so, we're enriched doubly by something that would have otherwise gone unnoticed and unappreciated. And appreciation, as we hear in the song of gratitude, is actually the axis of change. Without it, we become indifferent to ourselves. We become indifferent to others. We become embroiled in our circumstances. It dulls our discernment, prevents us from being involved with others. And if we aren't careful, we'll become unconsciously callous rather than consciously compassionate. And being callous will deny us the opportunity to receive from other people what we actually need to receive for ourselves. When you think about, I think Mark talked about the woman at the well story. It's in the fifth chapter of John. It suggests that this revolutionary nature of conscious compassion, where Jesus confronted a woman that was burdened, who was used to having burdens, who was used to bearing her pain, but he, in this simple exchange he had with her, he not only initiates a change in her, but it had a domino effect. because she then went out and ran, it says, into the city and told everybody what had just happened to her. So it's actually the best form of evangelism. It's not about talking to people about what the Bible says. It's about doing what it says and others seeing that and talking about it. And that's the best way, in my mind, for evangelism to occur. I can remember back in the day, we used to do evangelism at one of my churches of my history, and I was like, oh, my Lord, this is not going to work for me. So I don't know what I did, but I always got out of that. I was always able to get out of that, knocking on people's doors and talking about something in the Bible. So what's interesting is it's easy to tell people about the lost. That's how we would evangelize. We would tell people about the lost, knock on their doors, hello. And they would open their doors just a little bit. And we would tell them about the lost. That was so easy. But it's not so easy, right? While it's easy to tell the lost about being found, in some churches they do that and sermonize about it week after week. I can go places right now and I tell you at 11 o'clock that's what they're going to be doing. But what about telling the found, that is the privileged, of their failings? That's not so easy. What about telling the found of their failings? I can remember doing racial relations research here in North Carolina and across the U.S. Starting 30 years ago. And I was always amazed when white people would say, oh, race relations are great in America. And black people would say, race relations are awful in America. And all of the researchers, when I would present the results, just couldn't figure out why is it one group saw it as wonderful and another group saw it as awful. Well, now we probably have all awoke and see what the black folk was talking about, maybe. So let's talk about that. What about telling the found of their failings? What about calling into question the moral magic, which allows us to behave practically contrary to how we believe politically? What about using conscious compassion to challenge our assertions about our part of contributing to conditions that make compassion even necessary? How willing are we to engage ourselves in issues like impoverished schools, substandard housing, police brutality, and just this general climate of instability that's happening right now? So a couple of weeks ago, I mentioned the Pulitzer Prize winning book that I was reading called Evicted by Matthew Desmond. Anyone remember that? So it's about he follows eight families in Milwaukee as they struggle to keep a roof over their head. This book transformed my understanding. I thought I, knew it, and I was like, I knew nothing. It transformed my understanding of poverty and economic exploitation, which, while providing fresh ideas for solving some of our most devastating problems here in America. In this book, he paints scenes of hope and loss, which is meant to remind us of the centrality of home, the home where people live, which, without which nothing else is possible. So the writing, although giving insight into poverty and exploitation in Milwaukee, don't think it's just Milwaukee, is reminiscent of the challenges we have all over our land. In Greensboro, I looked at some data last night, 23% of the population lives below the poverty line. The national average, 14%. So I'm getting to the end. I want to give you a couple of quotes from Matthew's book. Here he's quoting, there's a quote within a quote. He's quoting Martin Luther King, and then he adds his own words. Every condition exists, Martin Luther King Jr. once wrote, simply because someone profits by its existence. This economic exploitation is crystallized in the slum. Exploitation, that's a word that's been scrubbed off of our poverty debate. No moral code or ethical principle, No piece of scripture or holy teaching can be summoned to defend what we have allowed our country to become. So how often does ignoring these blind spots create barren spaces in the lives of other people, especially in this current climate of political malfeasance? Can we be more consciously compassionate? Can we help encourage one another to be more consciously compassionate here in this county towards the hurting in our midst? Can we encourage each other to be more willing to engage in situations without condemning, to confront without blaming or shaming, as Jesus behaved with the woman at the well? Does our compassion enable others to believe in themselves, or does it produce passivity in them and complacency in us because of our refusal to be radical in addressing problems at their root? How much are we willing to be inconvenienced for standing for truth? How much are we willing to be inconvenienced, to not be so comfortable, to stand up for truth, to help in the lives of others? Isn't help what it's all about? When there was a researcher who looked at the obituaries, I forget how many, 100,000 obituaries, some crazy number like that. And he used this stuff we use in my work. It's like a computer software program to see where the trends were. Well, and the trends were, the thing that was similar among all those obituaries, whether the people were rich or poor, black or white, the thing that was the similarity was help. It always talked about so-and-so helped. Such-and-such person helped. It never said such-and-such person had a Mercedes. Such-and-such person had a 6,000-square-foot house. Never said that. Always in the obituary, which are written by who? Us, the ones who are left behind. What we want people to know is how they helped. That's what we want people to know about us, how we helped. There was also a research, I don't have this down, I'm trying to remember, it was about rats. You all know about the rat study where they took these rats, and it was all the same rats, but they divided, the researcher divided the rats, put them in two different cages, and put a sign on the cage saying, smart rats, dumb rats. They were all the same rats, y'all, just labeled them differently. Then had the students come in and choose which rats they wanted to from the cage, and then had them do this exercise where the rats would run to the end of the little runway thing or whatever it was. So they had an exercise for the smart rats and exactly the same exercise for the dumb rats. So which rats won? Which ones? The smart rats. You all say smart rats? Smart rats won? Anybody think it was the dumb rats? One person thinks it was the dumb rats. Maybe two. It was the smart rats. Why do you think it was the smart rats? Why do you think? Yeah, but why do you think the smart rats won? Uh-huh. And what was the bias? Right. So the smart rats were handled ever so gingerly by the students. The dumb rats, get in that cage. Right. So our bias, our expectations about people impact how we treat people. So let's continue to encourage one another, to edify and build up each other on this journey of observing, learning, growing, and ultimately loving. Let's smile at the stranger, particularly the cranky and stressed one, because, you know, smiling is contagious. Research shows to better understand one another, humans are programmed to mimic the expressions of others. So when we smile at someone, they'll have a hard time not smiling back. Even if they're faking it, they'll still benefit. According to researchers at University of Kansas, forcing a smile decreases their stress and increases their positive thoughts. What else can we do? Pick up the tab for the person behind you. Remember they used to do that at Starbucks? We would go to, there was after that movie about Pay It Forward, a lot of people were going to Starbucks or coffee shops and or McDonald's, whatever, and paying for the order behind them. You'd get up to the window and the person would say, oh, your order's already paid for. Oh my gosh, what a smile that would increase, would create on that person's face, and then they would do the same. Witnessing a kind act elicits an emotion called elevation, which increases our motivation to help others. Help out in a less fortunate neighborhood. In a Washington University study, older adults who donated more time were happier and healthier than those who gave less or none at all. So people have a sense of belonging and feeling connected to the communities that they live in are more likely to report better physical health than those who spend less time. So I want to close with this poem by Jeff Foster, who I met online. It's called Beyond the Mask. Never come to a conclusion about anyone. They will always surprise you. For they are still alive and ever-changing, with no fixed self to call their own. They are a cast of thousands, a shape-shifter, a parade of masks. Tragic, comic, fierce, ecstatic, numb. Don't confuse them with their appearance. See the universal self underneath. Breathe. Stay open. You will be humbled.
Thank you, Nancy, for your music. It's been lovely, too.
I also thank you for the message, and I was thinking you could retitle it, Breathe and Be Woke.
Yeah.
And it seemed like I was thinking especially about your grandmother, that she was a curandera for her community, but it was not only what she did, but it was also just who she was.
Yes.
So that's a thing like that, parts of, going out and doing things for all of us, but also just being more aware.
Being more present. Yeah. That's why she would sit on her porch, to be more present.
Thank you, Gracia. That was brilliant, and I really liked you gave us some steps, the concrete things. Since you told us the rat research, I quickly want to relate some other rat research that relates to addiction.
All right.
Because we're in the middle of this horrific opioid epidemic in this country. A lot of our understanding of addiction was based on some early rat research that turned out to be very, very flawed. In that research, once addicted, they deliberately addicted the rats. It looked like they would always choose to stay addicted. Hmm. And then a brilliant person looked at it and set up a different experiment where the rats were in a very rich, wonderful environment with other rats, mm-hmm. with rat toys, with mazes, with all kinds of things that they could do that were the kinds of things that rats love to do to be alive. Those rats did not choose to stay addicted.
Yeah. And I think the same thing for, that reminds me of when I was growing up, we always had people at our houses that I always wondered, who are these people? But that was just part of who we were, to always have these strangers, these strange children, staying and spending the night and eating and sharing. And these were people who, didn't have those kinds of opportunities for a decent quality life in their environments. And those little seeds changed their lives. And even to this day, I have a relative that is quadriplegic, no legs, multiple sclerosis, completely debilitating, and 3 months ago, and he always has someone in his house, by the way, who he's mentoring, who stays with him. And 3 months ago, he added someone else to his home who he's mentoring, and he called me to say last week, oh, I'm so excited. Aiden rode a bicycle. Aiden, who was staying with him as a high schooler who came from North Carolina to stay with him in Michigan, who had all kinds of hardship in his life, who was fearful of everything, fearful of doing the things that normal kids do, rode a bike, he said, to the shopping center. He had to actually cross the highway exit. And so, yeah, so when we change the environment, if we can do that, if we can sort of, you know, get out of our comfort and help change the environment for someone else, it changes their life.
Gretchen, this past Monday night at First Presbyterian Church, a program was put on by the Presbytery USA and several of the churches and Presbyterian churches in Greensboro were active in helping promote this program. We happen not to be one of them, but the building was full. A lady from Boston talked about many of the things that you shared with us today, and she has written a book, Waking Up White. And then she went on to share with us many of the things that she had found over a period of time. And I thought this was one that sort of ties in. She shared with us that after the Second World War, many of the black soldiers were not able to get home loans. And she gave the percentage, but it was astounding the difference between white men getting loans and black men not being able to get them. And I'm sure women felt in the same category. But anyway, she shared with us that her father bought a home in this exclusive area of Boston. He sold it, the family sold it at his death for $1 million. And the black boy, man, couldn't find a house to buy in Boston for hood. And I thought it just helped me understand some of the things that I wasn't aware of.
Yeah, thank you so much for sharing. That was a great, was disappointed that we weren't a part of that particular movement there at the Presbyterian, of the Presbyterian Church. But, yeah, I'm glad we were there. But, yeah, that's something, that's when I was talking about going deeper. That's what I'm talking about. A lot of times we go to the surface and we see things and we make judgments. And they're not necessarily the right judgments. We have to go deeper.
Thank you, Gracia. I'm Jane. And we value and your compassion and your ability to connect in where you grew up. I also wanted to mention, in case others are not aware, housing Greensboro, an incredible organization called the Refuge. They provide two-day workshops. And they have attracted participants of all backgrounds. And I just want to encourage you to look into that online. I'll be attending again tomorrow and Tuesday for the second time because I found it so rewarding.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for sharing. And that reminds me of a comment that was made Sunday before last by one of the members when they were talking about when the college kids move out, how they leave their refrigerators and stoves. Y'all remember that comment, kind of? So I was speaking with one of my friends recently who said that similar situation happened in their community in Richmond. And so what they did as a group was to encourage the students to create a business. And that business collected the refrigerators, collected the stoves, et cetera, and made them available to the nonprofits that could use them in the area. So when we hear people talking and speaking, you know, of problem, and they may be going in a particular direction, it's always an opportunity for us to dig deeper and find a solution. Thank you.
Anybody else? Thank you so much, Gracia. That was wonderful.